KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and a visiting research collaborator this year at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Today, I'm very excited to have on a return guest, Professor Gabriella Coleman of McGill, and author of the book that has been out now for several months, but still hyper current, Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, The Many Faces of Anonymous. Gabriella was on the show a few years ago discussing her work on open source hackers and the world of hacking, having immersed herself as an anthropologist in that community. In Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, Gabriella takes on the daunting task of attempting to do something similar within the very shadowy world of Anonymous. As I was preparing for today, having read the book and just looking around at there, I came across an Onion article from their, as they call it, their sister publication, Clickhole, pointing out Anonymous having revealed the address of the president at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Of course, obvious satire, but underlying that satire is the fact that Anonymous has gone from a somewhat obscure group 10 years ago to a group that has the cultural currency to have an Onion article written about it. And Gabriella, in her book, traces that history of Anonymous from a group that focused on, and we will define some of these terms for listeners who are not immersed in this world, focused on the lulls, focused on really pranks or worse, using technology, to a group that moved rapidly into the political sphere and has now become almost synonymous with the work of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, in the sense that they use technology to move policy levers in a way that heretofore had not been possible. So in the book, which is lengthy, and yet despite its length is eminently readable, Gabriella traces that history and her own personal experiences interacting with a variety of members of Anonymous, some of whom were known to her. In other words, she knew who they were, and others who were not. So a lot of the book intermixes direct chats, text chats between Gabriella and various people within the Anonymous world. And you get a very real sense of the kinds of communication that they have and really how they talk to each other, but more broadly, how the motivations of Anonymous are really quite complex. Like any decentralized organization, if you will, there are people there for a variety of reasons. And yet, at the same time, within Anonymous, Gabriella reveals that there are certain norms within that community that are enforced, both in a variety of ways that we've seen in virtual worlds, and we've seen in technology, and we've seen in places like Wikimedia, and even within the world of piracy. That is, there are things you do, and there's things that you don't. And so one of the conversations, or part of the conversation we're going to have today, is to kind of explore those norms and how they developed. The book itself is one, and I mentioned this to Gabriella before, but I'm going to mention it on the air because I think it's, at least I find it amusing. This was the book that I brought with me on a family trip and a cruise that we took over the holidays. And I just found it personally amusing that I was reading a book about a very serious topic with the Guy Fawkes mask on the cover, put ingeniously together on the cover through the use of computer keyboard tiles on a ship where kids are running around and having ice cream and swimming and whatever else. It's kind of that duality thing, which I at least personally found humorous, although I can assure you, the listeners, that I was the only one that found it funny. Be that as it may, for those of you that are not familiar, Gabriella is the Wolf Chair in Scientific and Technological Literacy at McGill University. She is trained as a cultural anthropologist, as she researches, writes about, and teaches on computer hackers and digital activism. As I mentioned, she is the author of Coding Freedom, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking, and she was on the show a few years ago discussing that book. We are recording the show on May 18th, 2015, and Gabriella is joining us via Skype. Thank you so much, Gabriella, for coming back on Hearsay Culture.
It's my pleasure. That was a great introduction.
Thanks much. Let's start off here, and for those that didn't hear the previous show, talk a bit more about your background and how you came to focus on Anonymous.
Well, I often like to say that Anonymous's entry into the political sphere was one ginormous accident. And in a similar way, the way I got to Anonymous was quite accidental as well. And this is the short version of the story. So when I was doing my research on open source hackers, I met quite a few hackers who really had a dislike of the Church of Scientology, and some had even gone so far as to protest the church or circulate secret church documents. And this was something I encountered during the course of my first project, but since it didn't really relate to it, I kind of put it aside. And then one year, I ended up being a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Alberta, and they happened to have the largest Scientology archives in the world. And so I figured this was a wonderful opportunity to look at some early battles between geeks, hackers, and Scientology over copyright, trademark, anonymous remailers, and that's precisely what I did. And this was the path that led me to Anonymous, because a few years later, Anonymous, which back in 2008 was simply a name used for internet trolling, well, they attacked the Church of Scientology. And because I had this big active project on the Church of Scientology and geeks and hackers, this seemed like a natural place to turn my attention to.
So we have, you know, with Anonymous, and again, many listeners will be familiar with Anonymous, but I suspect that others are not. In my introduction, I alluded to this transition, but before we talk about it, why don't we immediately identify perhaps some of the key events and reasons why Anonymous, in terms of what they've actually done as opposed to their underlying operations that we'll talk about. What is it that put Anonymous itself on the map?
Well, they are currently known for being a very rowdy, unruly protest ensemble, and they've engaged in over 200 operations around the world. But really, they got on the map, especially the activist map, first in 2008 when they pranked the Church of Scientology, but then they kind of had this pivot towards activism where they started to kind of earnestly protest the Church of Scientology. And then once again in 2010, they really received frenzied media attention in December of 2010 when they rose up in support of WikiLeaks after WikiLeaks had released the diplomatic cables that were provided by Chelsea Manning in all sorts of financial institutions and other companies, from Amazon to PayPal to MasterCard, had caved in to soft governmental pressure to pull the plug on giving services to WikiLeaks. And Anonymous then rose up and engaged in a very, very, very large distributed denial of service campaign. And that's where you kind of overwhelm a web page with too many requests, so it is inaccessible to the public. And so they took down PayPal and MasterCard's website. And this landed them, for example, on CNN. And soon after this momentous event in December 2010, they basically got involved in every major revolution around the world, from Tunisia to Occupy. And then their kind of profile was, you know, well, let's just put it this way, they became very commonly known after that period of time.
So you refer to, in the book, Anonymous as the, quote, quintessential anti-brand brand. And as an IP, as an intellectual property lawyer and scholar, when I see the word brand, it immediately sets off, you know, sirens. So what do you mean by Anonymous being the quintessential anti-brand brand?
So Anonymous's operations are quite distinct. Sometimes they rise up to defend internet freedom. In other moments, they're protesting police brutality. They don't have one kind of coherent political philosophy. But when it comes to their visual imagery, there are a kind of set number of stock icons and images. The two most important ones being the Guy Fawkes mask, which has a much longer history, and then the headless man or woman who's wearing a suit. And basically, those icons are their brand. It's the visual culture that's identified with Anonymous. It gives them kind of coherence. And yet, even though it kind of works as a brand insofar as it's the way to identify Anonymous and their style of operations, it's an anti-brand insofar as the whole point is that no one controls it. There is no ownership. And in fact, the whole point is to have different people take it for their own use. So its logic is the, you know, complete opposite of something like a trademark. But still, it kind of operates like a brand just because there's such visual consistency to a number of icons that are now indistinguishable from Anonymous.
When we think about this concept of hackers, hoaxer, whistleblower, spy, I'm going to ask this question, Gabrielle. It immediately brought to mind John le Carré's novels. Was that an inspiration here directly for the title itself?
It was, although I will admit that was my editors who came up with the first part of the title.
I see.
I came up with the many faces of Anonymous, which is, you know, not as brilliant as the first part. But I like both of them because, you know, hacker, hoaxer, whistleblower, spy clearly points to the fact that there's many faces, right? There's many dimensions to this entity. And while that's the case for all social political movements, there is a kind of pronounced dynamism, flexibility, and multitudinous quality to Anonymous that not all social movements kind of have.
And which is why I think it is a great title. And the subtitle, of course, you know, I think underscores that point. Not to parse it too closely, but I'm curious up front before we talk about what Anonymous is in more detail in this lingo, which is fascinating, and that we'll talk about too. But your title begins with the word hacker. And recognizing that there are many faces, is that pure alliteration? Or should we think of Anonymous first as hackers?
Yeah, you know, there is a way in which Anonymous is so interesting precisely because it is not just hackers compared to kind of other hacker domains of action like open source or let's just say the development of tools like Tor. Anonymous is far more populist and open. People who don't have deep technical skills absolutely have a happy home in Anonymous and play incredibly important roles, whether it is by being core organizers or media makers or, you know, just core supporters. So I think the hacking has often been exaggerated, and one of the reasons why Anonymous has spread the way it has is precisely because you don't need those deep technical skills. On the other hand, you know, the hackers are so pivotal to making Anonymous what it is. And they are the ones who erect and maintain the core infrastructure, communication infrastructure like internet relay chat. They're the ones who are able to pull off the DDoSing, the distributed denial of service attacks, which don't, you know, that doesn't require that much technical skill, but nevertheless, more than just a layperson would have. And then finally, Anonymous became particularly famous as well with the rise of small hacker groups within Anonymous, like LulzSec or AntiSec, who really went on these unbelievable hacking sprees that really peaked in 2011 and 2012. And so hacking is central to Anonymous, and yet you can't reduce everything about Anonymous to the hackers.
We're chatting with Gabrielle Coleman of McGill University, author of the book Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, The Many Faces of Anonymous on KZSU-FM Stanford. So let's dive in here a bit. And I want to ask you about the process of doing this book, which is fascinating, Gabrielle. But before we do that, there's a lot of idiosyncratic lingo within the world of Anonymous. So let's start here. Why Anonymous, and what does Anonymous mean in the context of this group?
Well, the name Basically came from an image board called 4chan. And 4chan is an image board that was created in 2003. And there's dozens upon dozens of different forums, topic forums on 4chan. But one of the interesting things about the board is that for the most part, everyone posts as anonymous. There's no persistent nicknames. There's no persistent even pseudonyms. Everyone, again, takes this handle or moniker of anonymous. And over the kind of years, a kind of collective identity around anonymous emerged from this image board, which is quite remarkable. And it was both kind of a collective identity that was used to coordinate some very fearsome internet pranks or trolling, but then there was also a kind of ethical commitment that grew around this idea of anonymous. And the idea basically is that one should not seek any personal fame or recognition for the work that they put out in the world, but it should be subsumed under this kind of collective name. And so I would say that's the core idea of anonymous. And obviously the name has changed over time because while it was once, you know, only and primarily associated with pranking or the image board 4chan, today it's primarily associated with an insurgent brand of activism, but this core idea that one should not seek fame or recognition for one's work is still the central pillar of being anonymous.
So along those same lines, and I've alluded to it and you've alluded to it, we have this word or I'll let you define it, lulls. So what is that?
So lulls, L-U-L-Z, is a bastardization and pluralization of, you know, the quite familiar laugh out loud. And lulls is a kind of name that designates a darker, more deviant form of humor where you get kind of pleasure at the misfortune of others. I mean, that's kind of the original meaning. Today, it's been stretched a little bit wider so that lulls can refer to more playful, even though transgressive forms of humor, to still retain this kind of very dark, deviant sense of humor. And it's a philosophy that anonymous is not alone in embracing. It's the philosophy of internet trolls generally, and internet trolls come in many different forms and types, from individuals such as Weave, W-E-E-V, who's featured in the book, who's not anonymous whatsoever in his trolling campaigns, to Anonymous, who was quite famous for their large-scale, crowdsourced, distributed anonymous trolling campaigns. But it's this kind of philosophy of humor in which you gain some sort of pleasure by pranking someone or, you know, literally by harming others as well.
So we have, and of course, we this is a show on KZSU-FM, so we have Federal Communication Commission regulations that make it difficult sometimes to discuss topics as directly as we'd like. But suffice to say that as part of understanding this community, there's a fair amount of humor that starts with juvenile and really moves into vulgar. And part of this culture of language is the use of pejorative terms involving homosexuals and other bodily functions. Without using those words, Gabriella, because frankly, I don't want to have to spend time bleeping you, as fun as that would be. There's clearly, as part of the way that this community communicates, the use of this language. Should it be dismissed as merely a bunch of juvenile guys, or is there more to it than that?
So first, I think it's worth mentioning that, even as Anonymous has moved away from fearsome pranking, absolutely the case, they haven't totally let go of the offensive language that you referred to. Although it's variably used by different participants, right? So some participants find it obnoxious and don't use it, and others come from this troll world, even as they've moved towards activism, and they believe that there's a kind of value in transgression, and so they continue to embrace it. And I think this is one of the more kind of difficult arenas or topics in Anonymous, because on the one hand, you know, I've met many people in Anonymous, even some who do use this offensive language, and their kind of offline personalities and backgrounds wouldn't suggest that they're just juvenile high school middle class boys at all. And in fact, one of the things that's so interesting about Anonymous is that it's far more diverse than people often assume. And really, as you know, I think understanding the offensive language, one has to move away from kind of models of individual behavior and psychology and understand that this comes out of a kind of whole cultural domain that embraces transgression. And that certain elements, I do think, are quite or can be quite regressive. And on the other hand, I think that there is something politically worthwhile in having a domain where people are willing to kind of break norms and rules, whether it's laws or language rules. But, you know, it is often quite dicey, and a number of people in Anonymous, this is my favorite example is Jeremy Hammond, who is a hacker who's serving 10 years in jail for participating in Anonymous. Well, he was really, really actually repelled by a lot of that language. And then eventually he decided that Anonymous was still engaging in really kind of politically progressive action, decided to kind of jump in anyways. So really the point being that even participants themselves struggle with the appropriateness of that offensive language that continues to have a place, especially within the kind of internal, inward-facing culture of Anonymous.
So, Gabrielle, before we take a very short break, and I think that's a nice segue into the method behind writing this book, because clearly that language, and if you take it merely as locker room type talk, is off-putting for those that aren't in that group. And as a woman writing in this area, it might be a challenge. On the other hand, because of the way that the community communicates with each other, one wouldn't necessarily know that you were anything other than someone in the community who has access to a computer. I think, from a research and scholarship perspective, what was your goal here before we talk a bit about how you got access to that group and your experience?
You know, I think at different moments I had different goals, but certainly part of a kind of core goal was simply to understand what was going on. I think one of the reasons why I'm fascinated by Anonymous is that while there's elements which I think are very straightforward and transparent, especially when they're engaging in certain political operations, they very clearly state what they want, they align with certain progressive liberal or leftist political movements, there's other dimensions to Anonymous which are very opaque. It's a world of opacity. And so part of the thrill and the academic impulse was to crack the puzzle, you know, to go through the maze that they had built and be able to go in and get out on the other side at some level. So that was one of the goals. But then they changed a little bit over time as well, because one thing was quite clear by the end of 2011 and beginning 2012, hackers like Jeremy Hammond and others were taking on enormous risks when they kind of hacked into, let's just say, private security firms. And there was a real risk that the public might see Anonymous as cyber terrorists and not as activists. And so part of my work was ensuring that, you know, the world saw them for what they are. And I still do think that they're activists, and one does not necessarily have to agree with everything that they've done. but what their actions don't constitute is terrorism. And so part of the goal of the work was to really kind of steer that ship away from that sort of framing, which is what, you know, the state might want to portray Anonymous as. And so that became a really strong, explicit goal of researching and writing about the group.
And, you know, again, I mean, I know I'm harping on it, but if you look at your title, you know, the hoaxer is probably only the only one, or the for lack of a better phrase, the most legal behavior here. Whistleblower, of course, connotes someone who's revealing information, but under the aegis of public interest or public good. And in fact, there could very well be a law protecting them. And nonetheless, you have to prove it. And of course, spy also has the aegis of law over it, but very well may and is violating laws in host countries. Across the board, we have that duality, I think, in all of these phrases. And I think the same duality seems to exist in your own experience based upon the details that you go through in a book about your own interactions in Anonymous. I certainly wondered, and I think, and it's definitely worth discussing on the air, how do you make an entree into a group like this? It's not like, you know, signing up on Facebook. What is it that you did to enter into this world?
So it's so funny you say that. Well, one of the fascinating things was that the first kind of activist iteration of Anonymous occurred again in 2008 when Anonymous made this jump from trolling to activism and protesting the Church of Scientology. And that node, they call themselves Chanology. Well, that node dropped the illegal tactics. They met in person. I went to their protests. And this was central to gaining access later on with a different node called Anonops, which was much more rooted in both secrecy and illegal tactics. So when Anonops came into being and started to kind of support WikiLeaks, I jumped into the fray, and I was completely nervous, racked by anxiety, precisely about gaining access, especially early on, because I knew that if I kind of messed up, they could just marginalize me, ban me, and that would be the end of it. And so for the first few weeks I was on their chat channels in December, I was actually quite quiet. I was talking to a few people, but I was really just basically being incredibly careful. I felt like I was basically walking on eggshells. And then one day I get kind of kicked out of the main reporter channel. And this was the moment that I decided, well, I must log back into the channel, the chat channel, and introduce myself. And it was a very vivid moment that I'll never forget. My heart was racing, and I precisely did that. I introduced myself. I explained who I was. I pointed to some of my work. And crucially, some of the participants already knew who I was, and they had seen some of the talks I had given about this other Anonymous cell, Chanology. And, you know, they seemed to like it, and they seemed to be sympathetic to me. And I was, you know, more or less accepted. And this was a huge relief. But obviously a lot was kept from me. And it took, you know, many, many more months of chatting with people and also contributing as a participant in order to gain even more access and trust. And even then, it was always partial, and it was only after the arrests of some of the hackers that I was also able to access data that was still being kept from me. But after people went through the legal system, they felt more comfortable opening up about some of the kind of illegal acts they had committed.
We're chatting with Professor Gabriella Coleman of McGill University, author of the book Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, The Many Faces of Anonymous, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. stanford.edu, or you can go to our page and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the show. You describe in the book, Gabriella, several instances where you were running this kind of dangerous, line between writing a book and being more involved in the community than perhaps you would have liked. Throughout that, I'm curious, what percentage of the people that you were ultimately communicating with figured out not only who you were, but that you had written a previous book on hackers? In other words, how much credibility do you think you might have or did develop by virtue of the fact that you had already establish a bit of a reputation for doing this kind of work within communities like this, admittedly not as you point out, as dangerous and edgy as Anonymous?
Having a public profile, having publications, having been interviewed by respected news organizations definitely all fed into the access and legitimacy that I had. But it also never felt guaranteed either, just because the collection of characters in Anonymous everyone's there for a different reason. They have very different backgrounds, and it's a entity or group, or groups within groups that are just, it's just very unpredictable. So while I think my history and public profile definitely helped tremendously, it did always feel somewhat precarious. But two things did help. One was just presence. Like, you really had to be present all the time. And I was. I was very lucky that in 2011, when activity was just explosive, I was on sabbatical. And so this meant that I could spend every single day, usually 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week, I was online for 5 to 6 hours a day, chatting with people, following conversations. And this is the only way to kind of know what was going on. And so all of a sudden, even though, again, some information was kept from me, and it was because it was very illegal information, and I wanted it kind of kept away from me. I didn't want to know about illegal activity as it was being planned. Nevertheless, I knew a lot. And in this world, knowledge is currency. And so I kind of held the currency. Then the other thing I did was I was this gopher between the world of journalism and Anonymous. And, I definitely portrayed Anonymous to the world by being interviewed, by my writing, but I got a tremendous number of journalists on the chat channels. I taught a lot of folks how to use internet relay chat so that they themselves could find participants and interview them. And I think the fact that I was doing this kind of work of translation, that I was contributing actual labor, that's how you also gain respect in these sorts of communities, right? So both the prior reputation and then the fact that I knew a lot and was able to work as well all kind of contributed to the access I was afforded.
One of the interesting angles here, and I think that access allowed you to do it, was you were able to identify, I think, in a very real way, what the threads might be in terms of norms within the community. It's kind of a tension, I think, in the book, because in some places it appears that there aren't philosophies and norms underlying Anonymous, and maybe I shouldn't use philosophy and norm together, but then, as you've already alluded to, there are, seeking publicity is frowned upon. Are there discernible threads in terms of why Anonymous exists that you can say are consistent throughout the group? I mean, perhaps it's lulls, but maybe not. Is there a way to say this is what Anonymous is in terms of its philosophy, even though, as your title suggests, there are lots of different things that Anonymous winds up being and doing?
Yeah, So there is this flexibility and dynamism to Anonymous. It's got many faces, as I mentioned, but absolutely there are really important, stable, logical threads that help bring coherence and stability to the activist world of Anonymous. I've already mentioned the importance of the kind of anti-ego celebrity ethic, so I really won't mention that more, except to say that that is such an important ethic, and it really traverses the different nodes, the different historical eras. It matters today as it mattered back then. And it's the one I am also very personally fascinated by because, you know, so much of our culture is about recognition and fame and celebrity, and I just really admire the fact that there is this domain that allows for people to experiment in a different kind of ethics of, you know, relating to other human beings, and that's wonderful. But it goes beyond that. And so, you know, many of the logics of work that occur in Anonymous, let's just say among the hackers, are very similar to the logics of work that are common to software development among hackers and open source. And one of the reasons why I included some of the chats of some of the hackers as they were working is to show that it's kind of really mundane in that way, and that there's these informal group dynamics of teamwork and consensus and division of labor and constant mentoring and teaching each other that are common in Anonymous as they're common in open source development. And, it, you know, some of the Anonymous hackers are also kind of open source developers. And so that's also really kind of important point of stability and a kind of logic. You know, I think another element as well is the fact that while there's a lot of secrecy because there's illegal action, Anonymous is trying to gain publicity. And they're very clear as to what they tend to want. And yes, there's tactics of deception or humor that get used, but quite a bit of the time, I would say the majority of the time, with their manifestos or their videos, what they say is what they mean as well. There is a kind of earnestness to most of their political operations, and that's also another point of stability that exists within Anonymous. So I do think that we can go too far in emphasizing its amorphous, dynamic, multitudinous quality, and it is really important to look at those points of stability that are ethical, that are technical, that are cultural, that do exist within Anonymous.
We're chatting with Gabriella Coleman, author of Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, The Many Faces of Anonymous, on Hearsay Culture. One of the interesting, and we're starting to approach, I guess I should say, with about 15 minutes left or so, Gabriella, the unfair portion of the show where I ask questions that you don't have time to answer adequately, and then I ask them anyway. So as we enter that realm, briefly, one of the areas that I think Anonymous, started getting a lot of attention, as you've alluded to, were the battles not only over the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement or ACTA, but they also, had a bit of a role in SOPA and in the defeat in the public sphere, really, of the Stop Online Piracy Act. The lulls moving from the lulls to opposing international trade agreements is a big jump. Within the Anonymous community, how much recognition is there and was there of these kinds of transformations? You allude to debates about what these different groups should be doing, and you suggest, of course, that splinter groups or subsets developed. But how much of this was really taken on with despite all the bravado trepidation? Was it a cautious move, or do you get the sense that people were ready to take on the challenge?
I think they were ready to take on the challenge, even though the initial jump with the Church of Scientology, that was probably one of the rougher transitions. And the reason why I say that is when Anonymous went from just simply trolling the Church of Scientology to earnestly protesting the Church of Scientology, a lot of the trolls were incredibly upset. They were pissed off. They were like, look, we're the internet hate machine. We belong on the internet. We are not about activism. And in fact, one of the worst trolls ever to occur under the name Anonymous happened soon after that transition. And I believe it happened in part because some of the trolls were so upset that some people had used this name for activism that they were trying to ruin the reputation of the name Anonymous so that it could not be used for activism. And what I'm referring to, the troll I'm referring to, is one against epilepsy forums where, you know, trolls taking the name Anonymous posted flashing pictures, which, you know, could cause, you know, huge medical issues, even kind of loss of life on these epilepsy forums. And this was really this dark moment because there had been this transition to activism, but clearly the trolls were trying to reclaim the name. But ultimately, and somewhat surprisingly, especially after that, they failed. And they failed precisely because in the subsequent years, Anonymous just was used more and more often for activism. And I do think that their involvement in particular supporting WikiLeaks, in particular fighting ACTA in Europe and SOPA in the United States, and then crucially getting involved in the historic social movements from the Indignado movement in Spain to Occupy to Wisconsin to the Arab Spring, those were crucial. Those were crucial because at a certain point it was clear that the name was being used more and more for these progressive purposes, and it became harder and harder for the trolls to kind of use the name simply for trolling. And actually there has not been a massive pure trolling campaign under the name Anonymous for years. That said, the lulls or trolling tactics still emerge during the course of political campaigns. And this is what gives Anonymous its bite, its insurgent quality, and also makes it very resistant to forms of co-optation because, you know, not everyone is willing to cheer Anonymous on precisely because they're willing to kind of push the moral, political, and legal envelope, even if they're not doing hardcore trolling. The inclusion of trolling tactics during these political campaigns make them quite morally dicey in the eyes of the, of some members of the public.
And so, Gabrielle, I mean, that, you know, that that last point there ties back into this anti-brand brand concept, because, you know, if one were to think about Anonymous up front, if we think about anonymity in the context of communications, or you think about anonymity generally, it's you don't know who I am, and therefore I have no identity except that I'm not known, which, as I think you point out, is very much a form of identity. And so one of the points I found interesting in reading the book is that there is a strong identity, even though it's built around this notion of not only anonymity but lack of publicity. You just used a word which I'm glad you mentioned because I wanted to ask you about it, the notion of co-optation. What does co-optation mean in the context of a group which, as you've pointed out, is very dynamic, has lots of different activities and meanings? At what point does one co-opt an organization or a group? I got to be careful, like Anonymous.
Right, you know, especially because Anonymous in some ways is a name precisely just to be taken by many, right? And so there's a way that at the political level, the whole point is to co-opt the name for your own purposes, and that has precisely happened. But what I think is interesting is that when it comes to kind of commodification of Anonymous through, let's just say, advertising, that, you know, Anonymous is kind of has been resistant to that. They haven't been the symbol that, let's just say, advertisers want to simply celebrate because they're afraid they might be hacked if they do that, Anonymous will just retaliate as well. And so you have this interesting phenomena where in our society, countercultural movements are very easily taken up by the mainstream. But what we have with Anonymous is actually a phenomena that was made popular by Hollywood, and here I'm just referring to V for Vendetta, and then was taken in some ways by the people through this political movement, Anonymous, and really has retained its very strong populist character. And it's certainly been the case that Anonymous has appeared in TV and film. House of Cards is one example, but there's others as well. But nevertheless, I think actually it just hasn't been heavily commodified in a way that, let's just say, punk rock was. And it's precisely because they're quite controversial and a lot of entities, a lot of corporations have been quite scared of Anonymous. So I think they've thought twice before deciding to just integrate that brand into their advertising machinery.
You know, which brings us to, again, unfair portion of the show, another interesting thread of secrecy within Anonymous. Again, by definition, I mean, anonymity is not the same as secrecy, and its parameters, I think, are quite different. But, right, you paint a picture of a group that simultaneously wants to maintain a fair amount of secrecy or, and also not the same thing, privacy, even while they are regularly focused on freeing information from control by governments and corporations. In what context do secrecy or the lever of secrecy serve their agenda?
Secrecy is important because they're breaking the law. You know, not everyone is anonymous, but there's individuals and small groups who do break the law for the purposes of political activity. The hacking, again, is the most famous. And so secrecy is their weapon to protect themselves, and I think it's completely legitimate to do this. And I think it's completely legitimate to do this because the punishments in the United States for this sort of activity are quite harsh. And so I don't think it's necessary that people take on the extreme risk. And they do take on the risk. I mean, whenever you commit the action, you're taking on the risk. But the secrecy just gives a little bit a layer of control. And that's precisely, you know, what Chelsea Manning did. She secretly gave the documents to WikiLeaks, right? And unfortunately, it was a very difficult secret to bear and had told the wrong person. And then we found out. But there was a very good chance that we maybe never would have found out who had provided the diplomatic cables to WikiLeaks and the video collateral murder. And so I think it is really important that secrecy remain a tactic that the kind of activist population can use for the purposes of organizing operations and also for engaging acts of whistleblowing as well.
You know, and that external secrecy, I think, is or can be contrasted with whatever internal secrecy there is. You know, even within, you know, within organizations, it's certainly possible. And, you know, of course, you think about, as you've alluded to already, you think about something like the intelligence community, where you may not know where everyone is. And in fact, unless you are the director of the CIA, you're not going to know where everyone is. How much, if you could tell, how much secrecy exists within Anonymous itself? Or amongst Anonymous?
Yeah, there is quite a bit of secrecy. And it does depend somewhat on the different node you're looking at. Some are more secret than others. And then in different moments, there was also more or less secrecy. But it was one of these interesting things where even people like hackers who were part of the most secretive groups, and again, they had to be secret because of the illegal nature of their activity. One of the interesting things was some of those individuals didn't necessarily have a full map of the entire network in which they were participating because of the fractured, decentralized nature of the networks and groups. And so some of the secrecies basically, for lack of a better word, kind of sociological or architectural. It just has to do with the fact that there's different groups who are working at the same time with a couple of people who move between the different groups. And so there's certain key core individuals, certain brokers who hold more secrets because they know the kind of architecture or the groups or the composition of groups. And so there is a kind of inherent architectural secrecy, which I kind of capture through the metaphor of the maze. They kind of build a maze, and no one within Anonymous has a total picture of the very maze that they themselves have built.
And that
one great example of this was I was talking to one person who, you know, was really in the know, and he was on many of the different chat channels, and he was explaining how there was one chat channel that was exactly the same as the other chat channel, except one person was excluded from one of the channels. And I asked why, and I was like, well, you know, he was a newcomer, we couldn't really trust him yet. And so you have this scenario where you have two channels that are exactly the same minus one person, right? And then that person is kept out of the secret, and everyone else in the channel knows that that person is out in the dark. Well, you have that scenario multiplied many times within Anonymous.
And so this brings us, we only have a couple of minutes left, Gabriella. We, you know, a very front and center topic right now is cybersecurity. And there are bills moving through Congress right now. We're recording on May 18th, 2015, that have been criticized by lots of groups, including security researchers themselves and the Electronic Frontier Foundation and others. You know, if you were going to speak to policymakers about cybersecurity using Anonymous as a referent, what lessons should policymakers take from Anonymous and its existence itself, because of course built throughout all of this is that they are breaching cybersecurity across a range of entities?
Well, I think the lesson that I might offer is based on the following quotes by Michael Walzer, who's a political theorist and who's writing about civil disobedience. And he wrote, "Thieves do not seek to limit the authority of the sovereign state, they seek to evade it. But there's nothing evasive about civil disobedience." And what I think is interesting about Anonymous is that they're very public. They're not like thieves that are seeking to evade the state. And in fact, I think the biggest cybersecurity threats are entities that are not like Anonymous, who are doing their work truly in the shadows, who are not being public about it, who are being very, very stealthy. And I do think that there's big cybersecurity risks when it comes to, let's just say, infrastructure in the United States. And so I wish more money would be invested in defense as opposed to demonizing groups like Anonymous, which, yes, they can definitely have an effect, and I don't want to minimize that, but in comparison to other entities, whether it's just, let's say, state hackers working on behalf of their governments in China or criminal groups, those threats are much more threatening. And the solution isn't simply to kind of criminalize the activity, but really to beef up security around critical infrastructure, which needs it. And so that's where the focus should be, as opposed to demonizing groups like Anonymous, which, you know, in comparison to more stealthy groups, don't really represent the core of the threat.
Professor Gabriella Coleman of McGill University, author of the fascinating book, Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, The Many Faces of Anonymous. Gabriella, your work is so interesting and not only insightful, but a pleasure to read. I would be remiss in not asking you as a last question, what's next? What are you working on right now? If you could talk about it. Speaking of secrecy, maybe I should probably more than anyone else, perhaps I should say that up front. So you're welcome to say thank you, Dave, for having me on the show, or feel free to say anything you'd like, or nothing.
No, I have a couple of projects in the work, and one is a kind of natural extension of Anonymous, although it jumps away from the illegal realm back to the legal realm. And one of the things I'm interested in is how Anonymous, Snowden, and Assange helped spur what I think is a pretty robust grassroots privacy movement that has been long in existence among hackers, right? The cypherpunks in the 1990s really had a well-articulated defense of privacy. But something has really changed in the last few years, and there's this tremendous activity and energy, a kind of renewed focus in fighting for privacy at many different levels, the policy level in D.C., tool development. We see that with projects like Tor or Leap. So I think I'm going to be looking at the kind of grassroots effort to build this privacy movement. And there's many different dimensions, but one of the ones I'm interested in is how groups like Tor fend off negative representations by law enforcement or mainstream media that tend to represent these tools as kind of safe havens for terrorists and pedophiles. And these groups have become way more media savvy in terms of how they're responding to their representations. Tor, for example, has hired a communications director. And so these very technical projects have had to become media advocacy projects. So that is one project. And then a very, very different project is on the intersection of computer hacking and disability. And that probably won't start for a couple years, but that's another project that's in the works.
Well, I look forward to having you back on the show if you will come back on the show to discuss these issues. I got to ask one last question. We're already at 56 minutes, but I'm going to do it anyway. Very quickly, 10 seconds. Have you stayed in touch with the people you chatted with at Anonymous, or is that chapter closed?
No, absolutely. Yeah. I'm staring at this IRC channel, which is a kind of reunion channel for a lot of those who had been arrested and now are free. And a big group of us will be at the Chaos Computer Club camp meeting in August, which is in Germany. It's a wonderful hacker conference. It only happens every 4 years out in the semi-wilderness. And a bunch of ex-Anons who have been, you know, unmasked by the states, as well as other kind of participants, will all be reuniting for camping in August. So definitely still in touch with them.
Gabriella, thank you so much for joining us on the show. A wonderful book, wonderful work. Thank you for taking the time. I look forward to having you back in the future.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was really a pleasure.
We have a very short amount of time left here, so I'm going to say very quickly, coming up for the remaining Hearsay Culture quarter, we have Professor Arvind Narayanan of Princeton on algorithmic computing and Bitcoin, Jacob Silverman, author of Terms of Service, Social Media, and the Price of Constant Connection, Margot Kaminsky of the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law on International Trade Surveillance and Artificial Intelligence, and Jason Arnold of Virginia Commonwealth University, author of Secrecy in the Sunshine Era, the Promise and Failures of U.S. Open Government Laws. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture this quarter, Wednesdays, 4 p.m. Pacific, on KZSU-FM Stanford. You can get the show by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu or via podcast by going to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society at Stanford, or the webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or the newly redesigned hearsayculture.com website, where you can get all previous 230-plus shows, as well as the upcoming schedule. Please email me at dave@hearsayculture.com or go to the new contact link at hearsayculture.com for any questions, feedback, comments, and the like. Otherwise, thank you for listening today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.